Welcome to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm your host, Umbreen Khan. Each week, we explore the beliefs that shape our world. Singing chants and swaying, some using prayer beads, a gathering of seven Krishna devotees are trying to get the attention of those walking by. We're at a busy intersection in downtown Silver Spring. Montgomery County, Maryland is home to more than a million residents, and it is one of the largest minority-majority counties in the country. The county is home to a growing network of diverse Hindu faith communities and faith-based organizations. Among them, the International Society of Krishna Consciousness. That's a religious nonprofit that was founded in the region more than 50 years ago. Among the diverse expressions of Hinduism, Hare Krishnas evangelize. In those early days, the community was small. Its members were primarily American converts. But that has changed in recent years. ISKCON has grown substantially. That's according to Richa Kermakar, a national reporter for the Religion News Service. Last week, she traveled to the Maryland suburb of Potomac, an affluent community in Montgomery County, where a new $14 million Hare Krishna temple was opened for a growing community of devotees who were drawn to the message and practices of the International Society of Krishna Consciousness. Kermakar is a national reporter based in New York. She earned her master's in journalism in religion at Columbia University. And in 2022, she was an intern on our show. So we've been following her work, and we're excited to hear about the stories she's been covering and the trends she's following. Describe for listeners what you saw.
So on Saturday, actually, what would be a lovely, beautiful spring day was rained out completely. So the organizers of this event didn't know what the turnout would be like. But of course, the sun kind of came up in this beautiful way just in time for the first darshan, which I was so happy to experience. It was just the crowd was pushing to get the first sight of these deities that were moved from the old temple down the hill to this brand new 11,000 square feet building. And the curtain revealed these deities and confetti went off. People were clamoring to get a peek and to have the divine see them. And this was just, music was playing, kirtan was loud and, you know, roaring. And this is just, there were people of really all ages just in awe of this reveal. And I think that was just a beautiful thing. The previous ISKCON DC temple, it was one of the first ISKCON temples in the United States, all the way back to the early 70s, was a kind of old house just down the hill, just on the same property as this new temple. And so the procession that was moving the idols of Krishna and Radha and Ram, Sita, these are moved from the old temple to this new building. It was just as grand of an affair and kind of bittersweet for some people.
Why was it bittersweet?
Some of the people who I talked to had been in this ISKCON DC community for, you know, more than 30 years. And of course, they had this small space that was just a handful of families at the time in the 90s. It has grown to this massive community. There's just more and more people are getting intrigued by this tradition. And I think they finally realized that, okay, they need a place to really support this growing community. And so it was bittersweet to leave this small place behind. But as I spoke to a few people, they're just happy that the building is still intact and it was not torn down and they can keep the property along with their two cows.
Well, you know, along with the two cows, let's talk about that for a second. There are two actual cows on the property?
That is what I heard. There are two cows on the property.
What role do the cows play?
Is that they have more than 600 communities throughout the world, and along with those communities, they have farming communities. They're very big on, you know, providing, and the seva, which means service that they perform, is kind of all related to agriculture as well. And I think that's a really, really interesting and beautiful part of this tradition.
You are swimming just like I am in the data that shows that there are a surplus number of houses of worship that are part of the Christian tradition, particularly that are no longer being fully utilized. You're describing a completely opposite trend.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I'd say the trend of Hindu temples in the United States is there are more opening every day. There are more initiatives, not just temples, but community Hindu initiatives that are, you know, increasing. And, you know, I would say the bottom line of all of these initiatives is to get the youth involved.
You know, when you were working as an intern, we actually worked on that story about youth summer camps. And there's a similarity here I want to make for a moment. Mm-hmm. For those who haven't listened, we'll include a link in this week's show notes. But the short story is a summer camp was started in the United States by converts who were focused on creating an ashram and a retreat. It was during the Vietnam War era in which there was a lot of exploration of Eastern traditions and thinking. But then as that movement started to dwindle and Indian immigrants moved into the area, they themselves found a need for more structured learning. Mm-hmm. Now they needed a space where they could socialize their families and their kids. And they started flocking to that retreat center, and new families and young families found a new home. And so that summer camp adapted. In some ways, when I was reading your story, the growth of ISKCON reminded me of that.
I definitely see a similarity. I think that something that's super interesting about the ISKCON community is that, yes, the ISKCON community as well, it started with, of course, Swami Prabhupada, who came to New York. And the story is he started chanting under this tree in Tompkins Square Park in New York City. And his early followers, his first followers, were all Americans, not Indian immigrants. And at that time, as it kind of grew, as this missionary movement moved across from the West to the East, it started off as, like you said, people during the Vietnam War were turning to these Eastern philosophies. And so that's a really, really interesting shift that's happened in this community. I will say when I went there, I would say a lot of people were of Indian heritage.
So describe to me the crowd.
When I went, it was, yes, I would say majority Indian origin people who maybe grew up in a Hindu Vaishnava household. But at the same time, these teachings, they say, are, you know, universal to all humans. And very specifically in several of the teachings from Swami Prabhupada, he emphasizes that, you know, our outside color, even our gender, our race, our ethnicity, anything, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. And I think that's why so many people of different races are so attracted.
How does it fit in the spectrum of expressions of Hinduism that you, you know, witnessed growing up in America?
That's a really interesting question. And I had my own questions about that as well, because, you know, I did ask a couple of people, do you consider yourself a Hindu? Do other people consider you as a Hindu? And, you know, the response I got was very, very interesting, where a lot of people say, no, this isn't even a religion. And I think that goes to just the expansiveness and the diversity of the Hindu tradition, which, you know, some people are even averse to calling Hindu dharma Hinduism, because that was another kind of label that was placed along with the word Hindu on Indians in general. And I think that when we think of religion in a Western sense, you think of, you know, these specific tenets that you adhere to. But the Hindu philosophy, as I get at in multiple of my stories, is a lot more diverse than that. And so a lot of the people I spoke to were actually reluctant to say that they had any religious identity, or even that ISKCON was a religion, just based on that perception of what religion is. And really, it's very interesting, because they would refer to ISKCON as maybe a faith-based organization, or really talk about, you know, their faith in larger themes like humanity, or, you know, the oneness of all, of unity. And I think that that goes to show just how, of course, like I said, how diverse the tradition is. This is this separate community of belonging. They find transcends any sort of religious identity. There are people who were previously of any, you know, maybe Abrahamic faith tradition, previously Hindu, but they found themselves adhering to this.
You know, you're reminding me of a lot of conversations I have had with people who practice yoga and who have really go deep into yogic philosophy, and they read the Vedas and the Upanishads, and they find themselves practicing all of these tenets and precepts within the yogic tradition, but they don't identify at all as it as a religion. They are very adamant that it is a philosophy that is integrated into their whatever religious identity they hold. So they hold it in duality with or in partnership with other beliefs. Rich, as you're talking about the variety of people who are part of the ISKCON community, you also profiled different members, including one who is a bit of a celebrity musician and singer who also has a really interesting family story. His name is Gauravani. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you learned?
Gauravani, probably about a decade ago, he had this singing group, this kirtan group, and he was kind of the lead singer in that, and so he is well known in the kirtan circles. It was interesting to hear his story. His mother was a Jewish woman, and she found herself in the Hare Krishna movement and raised, you know, Gauravani to be in the ISKCON community. And so, of course, we talked about this dual belonging aspect. I asked him, do you still relate to, you know, Judaism? He's raised his children with his wife in the ISKCON community. And of course, they are constantly kind of releasing music on YouTube together, music on whatever streaming services, and it's all Krishna conscious music. So it was really, really interesting. And he also teaches kirtan and mridanga, the drum that they're playing. He teaches those lessons to the youth.
Someone who sings kirtans, which are essentially religious songs of uplift, retelling stories from different odysseys and tales out of ancient Hindu text. You wrote that he describes himself as a Krishna kid and is centers his faith and tradition in not just one space, but in both. What is the reaction to the diversity of expressions of Hinduism that was on display?
I had a few takeaways from this event. One is that I think that the majority of them were devotees. This was just such a big event for the community at large, just because they celebrated their 50-year anniversary of having the ISKCON of DC community. And the other thing is that this was Gaura Purnima, which means the golden full moon, which is also the appearance day of Lord Chaitanya, according to the ISKCON holiday. More and more, as I continue on in my Hindu coverage, we can say there's just so much diversity as far as what philosophy you can follow. Can you be an atheist? The answer is yes. We have this cycle of life and death. And the biggest problem is getting out of that cycle. So that's, you know, that's a human thing.
I want to talk about one other story that you wrote that really caught my mind, because we are at the tail end of March, and I like to talk about women religious, Hindu women in particular, tapping into the ancient goddesses for guidance as a pathway for expressing their feminism. In the article that you wrote about the women, Hindu women in particular, it reminded me of a conversation I had with a family friend's daughter who'd gotten a tattoo on her arm of Kali. Okay, so before we go further, for those unfamiliar, in Indian mythology, Kali is the goddess of darkness, destruction, and death, and she is a symbol of Mother Nature. Kali is believed to be timeless and formless, representing the creation of life and the universe as well. She said a lot of her friends are really finding a sense of empowerment in the story of Kali. What role do women play in Hindu mythology?
women play such a kind of vital role in what we think of Hindu mythology. When we think of the majority of the Hindu gods who are, you know, male presenting, we oftentimes worship them alongside their female counterpart. To take that a step further, gender within the Hindu tradition, Hindu gods have avatars, which would mean incarnations of themselves. And in each of these incarnations, you know, it's not a given that your gender will remain the same. So there's men who are also women.
When you were writing the article, you were profiling a couple folks. What did you find in the way that these, you know, ancient avatars and deities manifest in a relevant way for women today?
One prime example of that would be a woman I've interviewed. Her name was Rachel previously, but was given the name Shakti, which it means power, but Shakti also is the female counterpart to Lord Shiva. And the idea there is that all of us have a feminine and masculine aspect to ourselves.
You wrote about Shakti Redding, and she's a yogi, mystic, and a psychologist based in Vail, Colorado. And you wrote about how she found her true calling after being introduced to some more esoteric philosophies. But her spiritual experience began as a Christian, but it wasn't just that. She had a traumatic experience that led her to begin to ask different questions.
So Shakti revealed to me that she had a terminated pregnancy when she was very young. And she told me that she had resulting shame, just grief, really. And this shame and grief didn't go away for a long time until she kind of found this call. She found yoga first, and through yoga and through being in nature is what she said, because, you know, Shakti, the goddess, is kind of very present in nature. She felt that there's this strong female power in the form of this divine energy that, you know, that you can worship. And she mentioned saying, like, when she pictured God as a kid, it was always this man who was looking down on her from the sky. And to know that there was a tradition where she could still feel, you know, faithful and still feel spiritual, that she could look to this woman and this female energy to kind of heal some of her traumas. Her eyes opened. Her life changed.
As she was sharing her story with you, what struck you about the role that communities like yoga play in introducing American audiences to yogic philosophy and Hinduism?
I think that people in the United States fall into one or more camps when they are learning about yoga or doing yoga or practicing yoga. The one camp would be, this is a great form of exercise, but then there's a whole other bucket of things that come from the yogic philosophy. As you know, yoga is not just asanas, the poses. Yoga is not just exercise. Yoga can be a lot more spiritual than that. It can be a way to kind of center yourself, your spirit or your soul, is what a lot of people think. At the same time, when yoga traces back to the Indian philosophical root, it's just this thing that opens up philosophy about chakras, or it opens up philosophy about natural healing, or about nature, or about meditation is a huge thing. No one's saying only Hindus should be able to do yoga. I think that it's a beautiful practice that did come out of India as a whole.
In your story, you profile Nirmala Chetty, who describes her journey into becoming someone who wants to bring the kind of ancient wisdoms and lessons on chakra healing that are rooted in the tradition as opposed to stripped of the tradition. Is Chetty's work finding an audience?
I would say yes. She goes by Dr. Sahila professionally, and Sahila would mean friend or companion. And she left her physician job to start this clinic. And she's also a teacher at the Hindu University of America.
What's been the response to her chakra healing?
for a lot of her students that I talked to her about, and this is Dr. Sahila, who has her clinic after dropping her job as a physician because she really, really believes in the powers of chakra healing. The Indian women in particular that she has worked with, they've realized that, you know, they've been missing out on something their whole life is what they told me. And they have realized that chakra healing, they had their own biases and their own misconceptions about what chakra healing really is or what chakras are. And that is in part what they would say, this perception that the West has taken.
Richa, before we go, was there any story that you've covered this month that we haven't touched on that you want to make sure you lift up for listeners?
I really hope people check out this story that I wrote March 1st about matchmaking, about Indian matchmaking, and how in the United States, it is becoming cool again. These are these matrimonial websites or services or matchmakers themselves who are, or even matchmaking conventions, who are really marketing themselves to this new age of Indian American young people who hold their traditional Indian identity.
One thing that it really reminded me of is the Netflix hit series, The Matchmaker, Indian Matchmaking, which I have to confess, I sat down and watched with my dad and we laughed a lot. it was really over the top, as often reality television does, right? I can't even imagine what it's like to be out there trying to meet people and really just wanting to find and know that you're going to meet somebody who's serious.
Yeah, and serious is a big thing because you never know, you know, what people's intentions are on dating apps. But the other big thing is, will this person be accepted by my family? And that's a whole other thing when we talk about Indian marriages is, you know, this marriage between two families. That's something that you can't find from just any dating app. And so Indian people, especially these children of immigrants, are really turning to these services because there's less of a stigma. And I will say that was because in part by this Netflix show that you're talking about, Indian Matchmaking.
Really?
People who watched Indian Matchmaking, and that wasn't just Indian diaspora kids, that was everyone kind of looking at matchmaking in the Indian community with a lot of curiosity, saying, oh, that's kind of interesting.
Richard, this trend has also raised concerns about a host of issues, from body shaming and socioeconomic pressures to race, specifically colorism.
Oh, yeah.
About the skin color of the girls. Questions about caste, you know, identifying your familial lineage and the taboos associated with mixing caste. And so there is an underbelly to some of the some of these traditions, I would just say, at least from my experience. But, you know, it is a reminder that we need to have lots of coverage about these trends because the Indian American and the South Asian American communities is only growing. And I hope that you'll join us again in conversation to talk about what you're hearing and seeing. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Richa. We will have links in this week's show notes to articles that Richa has authored for Religion News Service. Richa Karmakar, thank you for joining.
Thank you very much.
Richa Karmakar is a national religion reporter for the Religion News Service. In this week's show notes, we'll have links to the articles she's been writing and a little bit more background on the International Society of Krishna Consciousness. We'll be back after this short break. Hi, friends. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of our community. I don't know if you know this, but we are on the air all the way from Richmond, Virginia to Ketchikan, Alaska, and in so many places in between. We're a national show, and we are a small and mighty team committed to bringing you stories and sounds from around the world that convey not only the diversity and the pluralism of our country, but the beliefs that are shaping our world, our politics, our culture, and the ideas that sustain us and inspire us to think about where we are going. And that brings me to this question. If you value us, if you enjoy listening and appreciate what you're hearing, I want to ask you to take a moment to consider becoming a sustaining member of Interfaith Voices, or make a one-time donation at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. That's interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. Thank you, and let's get back to the show.